Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Nando Parado, who reads from and discusses his enthralling new book, Miracle in the Andes, 72 Days on the Mountain and My Long Trek Home, published by Crown. In the weeks to come, we have Augustin Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, John Berendt, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Through Piers Paul Reed's best-selling book Alive and the movie of the same name, most of you are familiar with the ordeal the Uruguayan rugby team whose plane crashed in the Andes. Not only did Nando Parado survive the crash more than 30 years ago, but his courage and determination led to the rescue of his 15 surviving teammates. Nando is with us tonight to share his incredible story and present his riveting new book, Miracle in the Andes, 72 Days on the Mountain and My Long Trek Home. Would you please join me in making Nando Parado feel welcome?
Thank you for coming. Thank you for your time. Thank you for coming and listening to me. I'm actually an author, maybe by chance. I was trying to write a book for my father before he died. He's 89. And for my family to tell them what my life had been, you know. But first of all, I shouldn't be here. I should be buried under a glacier 33 years ago. But because of many things, because of what we did over there, I was allowed to live. And it's a joy to wake up every day because deeply inside I understand that I shouldn't be here. I wrote that book and I never thought that this book would explode in the way that it has exploded. Generally, when something happens, a tragedy or something strong happens, or on a mountain, on the sea, on an earthquake, on war, a book is written immediately afterwards. 6 months, 4 months after something happens, a book is out. I waited 33 years to write this book. This is a book I couldn't have written before in any way. This is a book about my life before, during, and after the accident. And I am now, you look at me, but I was in 1920 then, and the average age on that plane accident was 18 years old. Of the 45 people on board, 95% had never seen or touched snow in their life before. And we survived one of the most hostile. We live in Uruguay. You know, Uruguay is on the Atlantic coast in South America, and our sports are surfing, water skiing, and beach volley. And we live exactly at sea level. We usually live across the street from the sea. So we had never seen mountains before in our lives. I mean, we had seen them on photos. We had seen them when we flew over them, but we had never touched them or been close to the mountains. So this is an ordeal that proved that you can survive without any previous training or survival experience. Because of what? Because we were a team, because we fought together. Because we were a team 10 years before that plane crash. Had this plane crash happened to a commercial airliner, I think it would have been very difficult to find survivors because they would have died on the first night. Because we were a team, we survived even the first night with temperatures to minus 35 degrees below zero. And we survived the only plane crash in history where there are survivors when a plane crashes at cruising speed and at cruising altitude. It's a miracle, and that's why I call this book A Miracle in the Andes, because there were so many miracles. How we supported the cold, it's incredible. There's no way I can explain that. Why we didn't freeze, why we didn't die, why we didn't die on the three impacts that the plane had when it crashed. at that altitude, at that speed, the physical forces that are unchained and those circumstances are really incredible. And we survived depression, fear. We were so afraid that our courage came from fear. And remember that we survived in the most hostile environment on Earth. We survived on a high-altitude glacier at 14,000 feet. You can survive on the sea, on the jungle, on a desert with more chances. But there, the mountains always kill you if you don't leave earlier enough. And because of what happened over there, I lost family members, my mother, my sister, my two best friends. And you change yourself. You change from a human being into a survival machine. And because of that, you think in a different way, in a way that you cannot even start to imagine sitting down there, how your mind changes, how fast and how difficult and different the thoughts might be. And when things go wrong in that magnitude, you forget everything. You leave everything out except the thoughts for your dear ones, for your family. Everything is erased in 1 second. It's like going to the doctor and he tells you, okay, I'm sorry, I have bad news. You will live only 2 weeks. How does your mind change? Immediately, things change, priorities change, and that was what happened to us. We were abandoned to die on a glacier. And because of that, we had to resort to very strange and difficult things to do to survive. We had to eat the dead bodies of our friends because that was the only thing we had to do. We couldn't leave that place. We were trapped by the environment, by the snow, by the ice, by the weather, by the climate. We had to wait for the summer to arrive. And waiting, so many things happened so slowly. 72 days and 72 nights, if you can imagine. When you read it into thin air, I met Beck Weathers, for example, into thin air, and he wrote in a book that he gave me, I only spent one night lost in the mountains. I cannot even start to imagine what 72 are, especially without ever before having seen snow in your life or touched snow. We had to do things that, seen from the outside, might seem strange, but for us, they were very, very normal, and that was the only way to survive. But besides those things, when you think that nothing can go wrong anymore, even surviving in that way, abandoned on a glacier, we were buried by an avalanche. We were 29 guys alive, and then 2.5 weeks after the crash, an avalanche buried 27 of the 29. And that's only 2.5 weeks after the plane crash. Then we had 2 more months there. We had to be very resourceful. We had to create many things to survive there, and we had to wait 5, 6, sometimes a week inside a small fuselage, one on top of the other one. And many things happen there. You speak, you talk, you are depressed, you cry, but you're still alive and you're still breathing. So you keep on going and going and going, but you also realize that even standing still and waiting, you're dying. What would happen when the food would finish, would end? There was no more. Nothing to eat. We would die. So I decided that I had to get out of there. And during 1.5 months, I prepared an expedition to cross the Andes. I didn't know I was going to cross the Andes. I thought I was going to climb one mountain and see the green valleys of Chile from there. And I thought that in one day I would be out of there. So I chose 2 of the best and the strongest guys over there. And we decided that we should climb that mountain, and from there, why that mountain? Because the only compass that we had was the sun. And the sun sets on the west. And to the west was the Pacific Ocean. Our only bearing and compass was the sun and the Pacific Ocean. It's like throwing you in the middle of the USA. You don't know where you are. You just look at the sun. And I say, okay, the sun sets on the west. California is that way. Okay, so, but how far away are we? 10 miles? 200? 600? 1,000? So that was our bearings, the sun and the Pacific Ocean. But we thought that we would be lucky, and climbing that mountain, we would see the green valleys of Chile. We fought, we climbed with our last strength, and when we reached the summit of the first mountain, we really realized that we were dead, because 360 degrees around us, we only saw snow-covered peaks. But we went on anyway. We walked for almost 9 days. We crossed 50 miles of rugged terrain, peaks, mountains, crevasses, whatever you can imagine exists on a chain of mountains. And I was flying over the Rockies here, coming to Denver and then to Salt Lake City. And they look so tame and so mild compared to the Andes. You fly over the Andes, and the Andes are higher. They are horrible to look from because all the sides of the mountains are steeper and rougher and higher and darker. And I mean, the Andes, they don't want you there. And at the end, they always win. If you don't leave earlier, the mountains always kill you. But finally, after almost 9 days, I lost 90 pounds of my weight. We found a peasant, and that was the first door to our escape. But of 45 people, only 16 survived. And we survived because of that teamwork, that leadership, that decision-making, and never giving up, never giving up. And that taught me, that experience taught me many things. But the best thing that I learned was when I got home, because my father told me, don't make the same mistake I made. I had everything planned in my life, everything, like a book with chapters. You would take charge of the family business, you would work when I would retire, and I would have a fantastic retirement with your mother. But I didn't write the chapter about the plane crash, and I never told your mother so many things I had to tell her, because I would have time later. And I never had time. So one of the things I learned, and that's why I wrote the book for him and for my family, for my wife, for my daughters, because the best lessons were after the plane crash. This is not a book about the ordeal. It is, but it's a love story. This is a book that women will absolutely love, because it's not an adventure book like Into Thin Air. This is the real Into Thin Air, because it's 72 days, not one night. And what we learned over there is what I think is important in life. We learned that love is the most important fuel in this world. As I told you before, if somebody comes to you now, or if you are in a difficult situation and they say, okay, that's what happened to us. We were waiting for a rescue, and we listened on the small transistor radio that the search has been abandoned. There are no survivors, the search has been abandoned. You go to the doctor, okay, you have 2 weeks to live. You have to put yourself into that frame of mind. And you'll remember that nothing matters except the people that are around you and that love you. So this is a book that deals with many things, a book I couldn't have written 33 years ago. And why did I write it? For my father, for my family. My wife pushed me because on many of the keynotes I give on different companies, different organizations all around the world, they asked me, do you have something written? Do you have something written? And 5 years ago I started writing something, and, well, the result is here. But I never thought it would have the impact it had. And for me it's a pleasure to be here to share with you parts of what happened there. And I will gladly answer any questions that you have, because I think this is also a part of the country, a part of the region of the United States that you understand outdoors, you see them, you look at them, you have the mountains around. And sometimes in countries where there are no mountains, they just do not understand what we went through. They thought it was a trek on the hills. And for me, that's why it's always a pleasure to come to the States, and especially to these parts of the country, because I love adventures, I love the outdoors, and if there's a place that has everything, is all this area in Colorado. So I will answer any questions that you have for the time that you need. I'm here. I'm one of you. Thank you. I wish I could answer and see what was in the head of all my friends over there, but something sparked first of all, I was there with my family and they were killed in the accident. I had my father back at home. He took us to the airport and he said, have a nice weekend. I will pick you up on Monday. And then he turned around and walked to the exit. And I remember him turning around. And he never knew he was not going to see his family ever again. Maybe that gave me the strength, that extra little bit of strength to say, I want to go back to my father. I have to go back. I want to tell him that I'm alive. And as soon as I heard the news on the radio, as soon as the radio stopped and some of the guys fell to the ground crying and depression, knelt down and embraced each other, I looked to the mountains to the west and I said, Jesus, that's what I'm going to be facing soon. Immediately, it was like 1, 2, 3 seconds after I finished that, I looked, I understood we were dead, but that I was going to fight. I was going to fight for my father. And if I look at me before the accident, probably I was not the most eligible guy to lead. I was an average student, good sportsman, but nothing that took me out from the average of the pack of the team, you know. And I think that the will to see my father was very, very important. Yes, I had to go back with the helicopters because it's such a long story. So many things happened, you know, in 72 days. I could speak here for hours and hours. But finally, the helicopters came and they showed me maps and they asked me where they are. And I drew a circle on the area that I thought that they were. And they said, that's impossible. You couldn't have crossed the whole range of in blue jeans and with those shoes and no gloves and nothing. And that area is 60, 70 miles away from here. And I told them, they are there on that glacier. And they say, okay, we cannot find that place. You have to come with us on the helicopter. So they strapped me on one of the rescue helicopters and they put me headphones, a microphone, and we took off and I was guiding them over the rivers, over the valleys, over the glaciers until we found them. And the elation of seeing those figures running about the fuselage was absolutely fantastic. First, because it was now almost 12 days since I have left the fuselage, and some of them were very weak when I left, and I thought that maybe two or three of them could have died in that period of time. And when the helicopter hovered over the place, it didn't land because it was very high and it didn't have enough power to take off afterwards. There were two guys from the mountain rescue team on my right, and they opened the door and they jumped out. They threw some bags out, and I saw two of my friends running towards the helicopter, and I opened the door here on the left. It's very fast, since the helicopter stopped and took off maybe 20, 30 seconds elapsed, not more than that. But I opened the door, and as soon as I opened the door, two of my guys dove into the helicopter, jumped inside, and their eyes were this big, you know, looking at me, and they embraced me, and they started kissing me, and then the helicopter left. The pilot said, we are too heavy, we are too heavy, I'm leaving. And it was a very, very nice feeling, no? Yeah, you have to remember, first, everything that we could see were mountains around us. It was like a bowl, completely surrounded with mountains. There was a valley that was going down, but we had mountains overlapping each other. So we couldn't, it was like everything was closed. We didn't see a pass in between those mountains, you know, going down. Also, the pilot, before dying, he said, we passed Curicó. We went over Curicó, and Curicó is in Chile. You know, he gave us that information, then he died. According to the speed of the airplane and the time we had been on the air, we calculated that on the westward route that we were flying towards Chile, but the plane was flying south in order to avoid a storm. So all that time that we thought the plane was flying west, it was flying south. So to us, we were at the end of the Andes in Chile because of the speed of the airplane, the time, what the pilot told us, and what we saw to the east were big mountains, only big mountains. But there was nothing behind those mountains, just the plains of Argentina. And we thought that going that way was going to be going into the middle of the Andes. And in our logic, the west was the only way out. And actually, it was the longer and most difficult way out. Because had we gone to the east, had we finally decided to go to the east, I've been back to the site of the crash 11 times, and we come from the east. But there are three rivers, which in December, they are very rough and very high because of the icing of the mountains. We would have been trapped by the rivers. In March, when we go and we climb up, the rivers are lower and we can cross them with horses. Even in March, in summer, you cannot cross them on foot. They are very wide and very strong. Class 5 rapids, you know, how can you swim there? There's no way. So it was the worst and longest direction, but we are here. So I have often thought about that, and some of that is in the book, but unluckily I can compare. Unluckily I went through something that I have never found afterwards in my life. Nothing that I have found in my life, in my work, in my relationships, in whatever you can find on a life of a human being, all the mistakes, all the problems, everything are like a joke compared to that. Every single problem I have found on my businesses, it's okay. I said, this is just a part of a puzzle that's life. And I have not ever found anything that can compare to that. So I have enjoyed my life and look forward with optimism, you know. There's always life after a tragedy. Bad things happen in life. I think and I wish all the lives would be perfect and straight and with nothing wrong, but there are problems with, you know, work, politics, illness, accidents, things happen in lives. And people say, why me? Why to me? Why not? You know, and there is life after the tragedy. I remember my friends, my mother and my sister, with tenderness, with, you know, I remember them with love, but not with pain. Pain went away. It's gone. And I always say, why not? Why should bad things always happen to the other people? You wish that would happen to other people, but sometimes you get hit also. So that's part of life too. And also people die. You know, in many ways. Natural death, accidents, illness. That's the only thing that you're sure of. The only problem is when. But I hope it's very late now. I've been brushed with death so many times and I hate it and I don't like it. But it will happen. So if you understand that, you can live with more peace. Was not easy because even if we take this group, not everybody thinks in the same way, you know? If I close the doors here and I say, okay, we're going to survive inside this room, and everybody will react in a different way. I will weld nobody will get out of here. I'll put the lights out, temperature to minus 30 degrees below zero, and let's see how we react. So people react in different ways. The best thing is that we knew each other. And we had like a selection for the best adapted guys for that. Some of the guys, even from the beginning, they say, I cannot go. It's not my thing. But he was good maybe making sunglasses or sewing the sleeping bag with copper wire. Everybody had its own task. But first we selected 6 or 7 of the guys at the beginning who were the strongest one physically, emotionally. And I said, okay, guys, we have to go. 3 of us will have to go. But then, avalanche, illness, cold, gangrene, natural selection, only 3 were left. And I was very afraid to leave, and I was very close to Roberto Ganesa. And I told him, I cannot go alone. You must come with me. I cannot do it alone. We are going to die. Can you imagine, Roberto, what will happen when we don't have any more food here? After what we had seen, what we had done, what's going to happen? I'm going to look at you and wait. I hope you die first. And then there will be 6 left, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then the mountains will take its toll. They would kill you at the end, you know? So let's get out of here, but come with me. I'm afraid to go alone. It was We had 2 months to deliver and to decide and talk and share things. But I knew I was going. I knew I was going definitely. And at the end, we were only three. And then only two after the second day in the trek, because it's a natural selection. We were three, but one was slower than the other two. So on the second day, I said, look, we are moving at your pace, not at our pace. And it was not thought or anything. It was instinct. It was perfect. We did the correct thing. We sent him back. He gave us his food, and we went further and longer, two of us, than three. I can assure you that none of the 16 had any survivor's guilt whatsoever. We had elation, we had happiness, and we understood that we had nothing to do with the selection of who would live and who would die. I mean, I've often read about survivor's guilt, and I speak with my fellow survivors and friends. We were friends 10 years before the crash. We went through the crash together, and we have been friends for 33 years afterwards. So we are very close, you can imagine. We are like brothers. And I said, what's this thing about survivor's guilt? And none of them can tell me. I don't know. I'm so happy. There's no way. I never felt any guilt for what? I mean, the only thing I did was to fight as hard as I could. And the other guys did the same. But an avalanche killed them, the cold, you know, gangrene. And that goes into religion and spirituality and God. Why did he decide that we should live and not them? And that's another very complicated issue. No? We were all Christian Catholics, raised in Catholicism. And we, when things go wrong, what do? You pray. And some pray just in case. But, yeah. Yeah. And we had so much time to discuss religion there. And we found that God, we came out much more, less Catholics, but much more spiritual in a way. We found a greater God, not the one that chose, okay, you would live, you would die, you would live, you would die. Why? And I said, why does God make that selection? Imagine how much the guys who died wanted to live. Why did they die? Why did my mother die, my sister, my two best friends? Why? There's no answer. So if we had an answer, we would have deciphered the mysteries of God and religion. So we feel more spiritual. We feel it's a different God, greater, creator of all the universe. But it's not the God we were taught in school that will punish you if you don't believe in him, if you don't go to confession, if you make sins. And we came out of there with the right to doubt without any guilt. You know, I don't know if it's clear. Here, you go to church. I go to church sometimes. You have to have faith. You have to be, if not, you will be punished. And God will take care of you. I said, Jesus, what is he talking about? You know? And that's what there's a nice chapter in the book about that. And I have discussed it with a priest who's a good friend, and he said, Jesus, I cannot answer what you say there. I mean, and he has studied theology for all his life. So if we could have deciphered that mystery, we would be, I mean, I would be a pope or something like that. But I'm just confused as much as everybody is, because nobody has an answer. But I can be confused without guilt. That's what came out of there. Yeah, we had some frostbite on our toes and our feet for a couple of months after we came out of there. But also remember that 90% of the time we spent it inside that fuselage. Not in the snow, with our feet in the snow, with our hands in the snow. Only on the trek out, and maybe some hours outside the fuselage when the weather was nice. You know, sometimes we spent a week inside the fuselage without going out. And there it was cold, but we didn't have the wind. We didn't have the added, you know, cold of the wind. And no. So we were cold. We were in very, very cold. But we didn't have a permanent frostbite. Some of the guys were very badly hurt because of the glare in the glaciers. Bobby Francois, he lost one eye completely burned by the glacier. And that gave us experience. I mean, we were doing research and development on how to survive there as we were going on. When the guys had their eyes hurting and crying and said, okay, get inside the fuselage, nobody goes out. Everybody bandaged, you know, when the sun was strong and we had to invent sunglasses to survive, like the Eskimos. I think that the answer is told by history. The 16 survivors are perfect family men, married. Only one has been divorced. They are all professionals. We have doctors, lawyers, ranchers, advertising agency directors. We went living our lives in a perfect way. We were not, involved by that celebrity status that probably because our country is small, everybody knows us, and had this happened to Americans or Germans or Canadians, they would have been... We can walk any place, we go every place, and okay, some people say, hi, how are you? But nobody... they know us all, you know? But we live our lives very, very gently and very normally after that. But it is true that the first year, 2 years, everybody was, oh, these are the survivors, look, these are the guys. But people changed towards us, not us towards the people, you know? I remember when I came back from the Andes to a place, a small restaurant where I used to go, and as soon as I got in there, I said, oh, it's an Ando. Before, nobody said anything. So they changed also, you know? But I think that history has the answer. If you look at them, they're absolutely perfect. We get together every December 22nd, the anniversary of the rescue, and they're married, children, grandchildren, some. So it's a nice story of love, friendship, and family at the end. No, I married Veronique, who's there at the back. I married her. I met her 5 years after the crash. So, but some guys married the girlfriends they had over there. Coach Inciarte, Roberto, they married their Alvaro, their girlfriends from other lives. We were a very good team, and 10 minutes after the crash, we were a team. Marcelo, our captain, was already organizing things, taking care of the wounded ones and building the wall because he understood that we wouldn't be rescued that day because it was late. Helicopters wouldn't come that day. They would come the next day. So we were working as a team 10, 15 minutes after the crash, even in that shock, you know, and that's because we knew each other perfectly for 10 years before the crash, and we knew the reactions, the personalities of each one, and there were also guys who were uplifted to levels of decision and work, and that it's incredible. I think he once won the boy there. That's good. I had to fly back to my home a week after I was rescued, so I was very, very afraid, obviously. But it took me about 2 years. I even took flying lessons because I loved the performance of airplanes, but I was very afraid, and now I fly. I have flown planes. I love the airplanes, the performance. But there's one guy, one of them, who had never stepped into an airplane again. Pancho Delgado, if you read the book, Pancho, he has never flown again. He said, no way, I'll never go to the States. I'll go on a boat to Europe. We fly to Chile, and he drives to Chile all the way. Takes him 2 days to drive. We fly there in 1.5 hours. But he drives. Oh, yeah, we had a lot of interaction with mountain people, especially with mountain climbers in the USA clubs in Boulder. I had a fantastic dinner once with 8 of the best elite climbers in the USA. And we interacted, and I was asking them so many questions, and they were asking me, how did you do this? How did you do that? How did you do that? No oxygen, no crampons, no ice access, no ropes, no clothes, nothing. They said, you did what we dream of doing. You climbed so light. You climbed so fast. Yeah. And And with it, the difference is that you go there because you like it, and you're doing a sport, you're doing a something that it's your passion. We were dying. That's the difference. For us, it was imperative to go up to see what it was. For you, it's imperative to go down and survive. And I learned a lot, especially about dehydration at that altitude. I learned through them how fast you dehydrate at that altitude. You need 5 times more water than at sea level. And our thirst was non-stop, 24 hours a day. Your body craves for water. You need water. You need water. You need, even that cold, you need water. And we couldn't make water. We had to put snow and ice in our mouths. And a few days, we made a water-making machine with pieces of aluminium, you know, when there was sun. But there were maybe 10, 12 days, all through 2.5 months. The rest, we just ate snow. And thirst was one of the worst things there. The sensation is the one that never goes away is the realization that you are dead. Not the cold or the thirst. I remember those, but the feeling that, you know, there's no way out. You're going to die. There's no way out. You know, it's like being in front of a firing squad. You have your eyes bandaged. Your hands are behind your back. And you feel, you hear the guy saying, prepare, aim. What do you feel at that moment? And that's what we felt 72 days nonstop here. You know, that's what I'll never forget. Yeah, I think the ignorance helped us, because had we known where we were, what we were going to face, we would say, okay, it's like saying, okay, you have to swim from California to Hawaii. You say, no, I'll never start. But if you're there in the water and say, okay, where do I start swimming? Let's start swimming that way. Maybe you'll get there. So we didn't know where we were, what we were going to face. So I think the ignorance helped us. Those things are very important, especially you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. You know? Are you sure what's going to happen tomorrow? Yeah, you're planning to go maybe out Saturday or whatever, but you're not sure. Maybe God has other plans for you. And we always say that you should live your life plentifully. Not those very romantic things. Live your life. This is the first day of the rest of your life. You know, those are nice hippie things, nice slogans. But in a way, they have some truth, you know. There's no way you can modify the past. Even if there's a tragedy, if there, whatever there is, you cannot modify the past. You have to live, and live for the ones that are around you, live the future, the present especially. But also many, many times companies ask us to go because our history in the Andes, we didn't know that, and we don't even understand why, has been taken by the most important universities in the world, you know, Harvard, Columbia, UCLA, Brown, Wharton School of Business, ESA in Spain, you know, Germany, Italy, as a perfect example of excellence in many fields, and achieved when we were very young. And they applied that, those things, to their education plans and to some of the things you have to do on a company, on a business, because when things go wrong on a business, sometimes leaders and CEOs are so well trained that they don't allow themselves to break the rules and things go wrong. Better. No, we understood that bad things happen. You know, we know why it crashed. The pilot made a mistake. Pilot navigation mistake, big one. But okay, now we're down, we crashed, now we survived. What can we do? We can sue the Uruguayan Air Force, get into legal problems. That just happened. And Hurricane Katrina, it's nature. It just came and hit New Orleans. And okay, the responses and what happened afterwards, that's different. But the hurricane was doing its own thing, you know.
When you guys heard that, okay, the calm was.
Yeah, but they search, and remember, it's South America. The resources are 33 years ago. They were not. Uruguay had only 3 planes. One crashed with us, you know. Chile spent a lot of man hours and times and airplanes searching for 10 days. Argentina also. But they were searching 100 miles away from where we were. And how long do you search? You know, the state doesn't have a heart, a feeling. They say, okay, 10 days we have spent. We don't have any more man hours. We have other things to do. And we couldn't do anything. We were angry. We were very angry. You are right. We were angry when we heard that. But angry then turns to acceptance when you know that they are not coming. Yeah, there were conversations about, you know, Jesus, we are. The language that we used over there, it's like war language. It's not soft language. It's a language that said, Jesus, we are dead. There's no way out. There's no way. Yeah, but we are still breathing. Come on. Are you breathing? Yeah. What does it mean that you're alive? You're still alive. Let's fight until you don't breathe anymore. And I never felt the urge to cease my fight. I say, as long as I'm breathing, I will push until I'm dead. And I told to myself many times, the last thing that I will see in my life, the last vision that I will have, is my face hitting the ice. When I hit the ice, and I imagine my face coming, you know, like on a movie, to the ice and hitting the ice. That was the last thing I would see, and I would die. And until that happened, I said, I'm keeping on going. It was very simple thoughts, but we couldn't elaborate more profound thoughts because there was no future. Our future was the next hour, the next 2 hours, the next 3 hours, not even the next day. And we said, let's take, you know, a day at a time, hours at a time. And if we are alive tomorrow, we'll be alive maybe to fight one more day. And in my mind, I never faltered. I never said, okay, I won't fight. I'm done. Why? I don't know. But I kept on pushing until the last second. You know that it's that's another one of the miracles I think of my life. And since the first night at the hospital in Santiago 33 and a half years ago, I never had a dream or a nightmare about this thing. Never. Why? I cannot explain it. I don't know. I have to be honest. I could say, yeah, I dream and I wake up at night and I say, oh, Jesus, no, I'm here, I'm safe. But no, I never. I had nightmares over there. I knew I was going to wake up and I was going to see my room, you know, my racing car posters, and I was asleep there. And I said, I'll wake up, I will open my eyes and I will be in my room. And suddenly I opened my eyes and I was inside that hell, you know. So I had nightmares there, not afterwards. But I remember, I it's not that you forget, but I remember when I'm awake, not when I'm sleeping. When we came out, a lot of the people that were around us said, okay, you need some counseling. And they were very, very strong with that idea. So we got together in Gustavo Servino's house for a barbecue, the 16, and we said, hey, these parents, these people are pesting us with this thing about the going to, you know, counseling. And who's going to counsel us about what? Yeah, about it really. We go to a shrink, and what's his experience in this case? And we said, look, he will counsel us, and then he will write an essay. I counsel the survivors, and he would gain experience with us. So we said, if I need some counseling, I will call you, and you call me, okay? I call you. But that's exactly what happened. We said, who has any experience with this? What can he say? Tell us. And we were so elated, so happy to be back to life. It was much worse to be back from normal life to that glacier than to come back from the glacier to normal life. It came out, it's explained in the book, and it's long because it's not like you dial 911 and the helicopter goes and picks you up, because it takes 2 days, the rescue. You know, we were far deep in the mountains, and it takes a lot of logistics, very slow logistics because of the distances and lack of communications at that time. But we were rescued finally by helicopters. You know? But it took a day and a half for the helicopters to arrive after we saw the peasant. So it takes a long time. You know? But it was very emotional. Yeah, I describe it that way. Maybe it was my brain trying to start up again, no, slowly. Because it's a way of describing what was going inside my head. It was like like you saw the movie Alien, you know, the alien that was inside you. I had like an alien inside my head. It was hurting so bad, and I was trying to start to come back to my senses, and I heard these voices, or it was my brain, or it was myself, and saying, what's going on here? I have to wake up. Where am I? You know, and then I woke up, but slowly. It took me 5, 6, 8 hours to come back to my senses, slowly. And it was me speaking to myself, or my mind trying to absorb what was going on there. You know? But it was a dark and perfect silence at the beginning. I was dead. And it's very black and very silent. I think we could... I don't know if there are no more questions. One more?
You could rewrite.
Yeah, incredibly enough, I would get on that plane again. Many years ago, I would never get on that plane. You know, because life is a balance, it's equilibrium, it's payback time for something. And I lost many things. I lost my mother, my sister, my friends, my life, everything. But because of that plane crash, I later in my life found my wife. And because of that, I had my family now. So I would have to select now my family that I have now from the ones that I lost. So it's a very difficult choice. But I think I would select the ones I have now, because it's my blood, my children, my family. You know?
I'm sorry, I don't
know. No, there's a communal grave there, right near where the plane crashed, about 100 yards, because the plane stopped on a glacier, and the glacier moves, and it's ice. But about 100 yards from there, there's the side of a mountain where it's rock. So the grave has been there, and my family, my friends are buried there. And the fuselage has been swollen by the glacier. It opens and it closes, and it was... But there's still this one wing and debris of the airplane around the area. I think, thank you very much. And
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Augustine Burroughs, Madeline Albright, Elizabeth Berg, John Berendt, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on May 12th, 2006.